From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up today, 2019 in memoriam. Bill McGonigal of the Boston Housing Authority, who changed the lives of thousands.
I hope my legacy is one of inclusion, someone who made a sincere effort to open up the public housing in the city.
Author Toni Morrison.
It's something that we can say about Toni Morrison. She gave us all the pieces in all the right order.
John Singleton, maker of films like Boys in the Hood.
So often we're rendered in black and white. And that's what he really tried to avoid doing with his films.
And Rick Ocasek of The Cars.
We ventured to Boston in 1972
and heard the Modern Lovers playing on the Common.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this is the place for me.
Lives too important to leave behind. Next on WBUR's Radio Boston. Welcome to a special Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's New Year's Eve, and even as we're getting ready to welcome 2020, our hearts are still filled with 2019. We lost public figures this year who had a deep and lasting effect on our lives. We want to take this hour to remember them so we carry their legacy with us into 2020. Let's start with a man who made life better for thousands of people here in Boston, Bill McGonigal, the longtime head of the Boston Housing Authority. McGonigal himself grew up in public housing in South Boston. He then worked for the Housing Authority for an amazing 40 years, starting as a janitor and eventually working his way up to the top role. He died in October at the age of 67 and just after retiring. Shortly before he died, he joined us on Radio Boston and told us why he felt called to work for the Housing Authority.
First and foremost, I grew up in public housing in Boston and the Mary Ellen McCormick housing development over in South Boston, first public housing development built in New England. So I had an interest in public housing and public housing advocacy literally from the day I was born. I've always had a desire to help people, and I thought that there is no better way to accomplish that goal than to be working on behalf of the poorest and most marginalized people in the city of Boston.
So you really did set out from the beginning for a life of service in this kind of capacity.
Yes. I mean, there would not be a day in my 67 years that I have not had some connection, some relationship with the Boston Housing Authority, either as a resident, as someone that is working with residents in another capacity outside of the Boston Housing Authority, or as an employee of the Boston Housing Authority. So clearly this has been my life's mission.
So you grew up in the McCormick. How have conditions in that particular public housing complex, for example, changed from when you lived there to when you started the job to now?
A couple of things. Certainly it is a lot more diverse than when I grew up there. When I grew up there, it was a predominantly Irish Catholic public housing community. Most of the public housing in our city was segregated at that time and reflected the racial and demographic makeup of the surrounding neighborhoods. Right now, the Mary Ellen McCormick housing development, the population there speaks roughly 28 different languages. It is one of the most diverse census tracts in the United States of America, so that is certainly a significant change. The other thing, quite frankly, is it's older, and as a result is in significant need of a major capital improvement.
The fact that public housing today is less segregated, significantly more diverse, you actually had something to do with that. It's something I'd love to hear more about. Back at one point, you were the executive assistant to former director Doris Bunty, and your main goal in that role was to racially integrate public housing in Charlestown and South Boston, which were mostly all white neighborhoods at the time. That initiative really was the result of an NAACP lawsuit in 1988. Tell us a bit about the political climate at the time that you started doing that work.
Yeah, I had a role in a visible role in that effort. But again, as I have indicated always in the past, I don't want to take too much credit. Again, I think the real heroes of that integration effort were the Bessie Paynes, the Liz Klingscales, who were the first two families of color to move into South Boston.
Why? Why were they the real heroes?
Well, they were the ones that took the most risk, quite frankly, and they were the ones that were the pioneers and took the chance to move themselves and their families into a community where, in some instances, they were not terribly welcome.
Did you feel that your own experience growing up in public housing in Boston gave you a particular credibility to speak to both the white communities and families of color during the process of integrating South Boston and Charlestown's public housing?
I think one of the things I am most proud of in my tenure at the BHA is, quite frankly, my relationship, my trusting relationship that I've been able to establish with the public housing residents all over the city.
Despite your credibility with the public housing residents and your official role with the Boston Housing Authority, you actually faced violence during that time of attempts to desegregate. Can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, at one point early in the morning, my BHA vehicle, marked vehicle, was parked in front of my house in Southie, and somebody took some shots at it. I think four or five bullets were shot into the vehicle.
Were you in the vehicle at the time?
I was not. I was actually upstairs shaving, quite frankly, and my wife and a couple of my kids were downstairs in the kitchen having breakfast. I thought at first it was an engine backfiring or something, but I did look to the window and I saw a car, a late model dark car, racing away. In any event, my family was safe and sound. And I continued my work at the BHA and was not going to be deterred from my work by any kind of act of violence.
I'd love to hear what you're hearing from the public housing residents with whom you work. This is a city where to have your own apartment, at least according to a study that was out last year from an apartment search engine called Nestpick, you need to make over $78,000 a year. Your average resident makes $15,000 a year. What are they saying to you?
It never ceases to amaze me, quite frankly, how our families are able to make do. I mean, their rent is set at 30% of their incomes. And if someone has zero income, and we have some of them, I was taught, I think, in the fourth grade, 30% of zero is zero. So we have some zero rents. But even if you're averaging $15,000 a year in income, and your rent is a few hundred dollars a month, that doesn't leave a lot on the table for food, for clothing, for your children. I am always amazed at how creative our families are in providing for their families. And it clearly has to be and is an economic struggle for them.
Talking about the creativity and I might even suggest resilience, as you have, of residents who are making it work on $15,000 a year is a different way to talk about low-income communities in Boston than we hear from some other voices. You are known as and respected for your anti-poverty advocacy in general. How important is anti-poverty advocacy in today's Boston?
Extremely important. The cost of living in Boston is going up. I do think that we, the BHA, is following a path of redevelopment that will preserve all of the deeply affordable units that we have. I think the city, the mayor, and Sheila Dillon are doing a wonderful job. We're producing affordable housing units at a pace that has never been accomplished in this city, but it is still a struggle to keep up. One of the things I would suggest is that it is time for the federal government to reengage and to step up to the plate and commit some financial resources to the development of affordable housing in Boston and in Massachusetts and throughout the country. They have retreated. They are running away from adequately funding the public housing program, and they're running away from the development of affordable housing here in Boston, in the Commonwealth, and throughout the country.
So outside of the question of housing, what other initiatives would you like to see either the city or the federal government investing in for the most vulnerable and most low-income residents of Boston?
You know, I think one of the things, the homelessness problem is driven, at least to some degree, not entirely, but there is a lot of or a significant problem with opioid addictions as well. I mean, when you walk up and down the streets of the city, in my neighborhood, quite frankly, on Dorchester Street in Southie, the evidence of the opioid epidemic and its impact on homelessness is quite obvious. It's there for anybody to see. And I think the city and the federal government stepping up to the plate around dealing with that crisis, and I think the mayor's initiatives around reopening the Long Island shelter, I certainly think that is something that would be a huge step forward in terms of providing services. I think the job training would certainly be something that is helpful, job opportunities. I think providing adequate daycare for families. How does a single mom with three kids and doesn't have access to daycare go out and find herself a meaningful job where she can't leave her three kids at home all by themselves all day? So I think there's a combination of factors, social factors, and programs that government, the city, the state, and the federal government needs to provide funding for and support for. That can more effectively deal with the homelessness crisis that we're seeing all over the country.
When you look back at your 40-year career, what do you hope will be your legacy?
I hope my legacy is one of inclusion, someone who made a sincere effort to open up the public housing in the city to residents, applicants, those in need of housing, of every racial and ethnic background, and that I empowered residents and listened to them and brought them to the table when it came time to make decisions.
That was Bill McGonigal, the longtime head of the Boston Housing Authority. McGonigal passed away in October at the age of 67. Stay with us. Coming up, we remember two African-American artists who forever changed America's literature and film. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. As we get ready to welcome 2020, we are remembering the lives of some public figures we lost this year, but whom we are not willing to leave behind. We want to take their legacies with us into the new year. We just heard from the longtime head of the Boston Housing Authority, Bill McGonigal. Now, let's turn to someone who changed literature and also the way we see the world.
I wanted to separate color from race. Distinguishing color, light, black, in between, as the marker for race is really an error.
Nobel laureate Toni Morrison. She died in August in New York, and she was 88 years old. The author of 11 novels, including Beloved, Bluest Eye, Song of Solomon, Morrison was the first black woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. She also received a Pulitzer Prize and a Presidential Medal of Freedom. Her work impacted a generation of artists, writers, activists in this country and here in Boston. Earlier this year, we spoke about Morrison's life and legacy with Janae Osterholt, a cultural writer for the Boston Globe, and Jabari Asim, associate professor and director of Emerson College's Graduate Creative Writing Program. Janae began by talking about what Toni Morrison meant to her personally.
Permission, grace, a mastery of language that's unmatched, but more than anything, a safe space to be fully myself, to be fully black, to be writing for other people who are black outside of the white gaze. I just feel like there's this thing that happens when you're a black body living in a white country, and you're always kind of in that lens, under that microscope. And she got rid of that and created a world that was just ours for us. And I think it was a great permission for a lot of us.
So, Jabari, one of the things that Janae just said was she referred to the white gaze, which is something that Toni Morrison talked about in at least one interview, but I think more than once.
Mm-hmm.
How did her work step outside of the white gaze and create permission for black writers to do that?
Well, I think she was pretty outspoken about putting the black story, putting black people at the center of the narrative. And she, she condemned this white impulse to push aside the black narrative. She called it the master narrative, in which the powerful impose the story on the powerless. And her writing was, even in her fiction and nonfiction, very much an eloquent rejoinder to this impulse to marginalize black experience.
Jabari, I'm going to stay with you for a minute longer and ask you, what did her work mean to you?
Well, she was an elder. She was the generation that preceded mine. And, I don't want to abuse the term that Janae, rightly introduced, permission, but it was sort of very much in that vein. She sort of opened a path that had existed before her, but which she sort of blasted open. And said, you don't have to write about what you know, which is what we're always told. Write about what you don't know and don't be afraid of anything. So it was this fearlessness, this combination of eloquence and power, which set, a righteous example for the rest of us, something to aspire to.
Janae, her first novel, The Bluest Eye, started as a short story in a workshop, and it took her about 5 years to write. It was first published in 1970. Here's what Toni Morrison said in an interview in 1988 about what initially inspired her to begin writing this story of a young African-American girl growing up after the Great Depression.
The very first book I wrote, called The Bluest Eye, was when I was not really thinking about publishing or reviewers or other readers. It was a book I wanted to read, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So I began to write it.
What gap was she filling in that first book and early in her career?
Visibility. It's not just a gap. It was erasure. Over and over again, I've talked to different women, black women, over the last 24 hours about Toni Morrison in group chats and group me and just among friends and peers. And that book is the book that comes up the most. And I think for a lot of black women collectively, it's like the first time they felt seen, because there is a great erasure of black people, but especially black women. So I feel like in many ways, what Jabari was saying, how she blasted that door open, it also was a corrective. Like, I feel like her whole canon in many ways is a corrective to erasure and kind of like the lost files of Black American experiences. And I think she just continues to, sorry.
No, you're great.
Sort of live with us and just wrap us, in her words, like a hug. It was a hug.
Jabari, let's remember her life. Tell us a little more about her life, if you can.
Sure. I mean, she was born in 1931 in Lorain, Ohio. Early in her career, she was a really important editor at Random House. She studied undergrad at Howard University, graduate school at Cornell, taught at Howard, and eventually at Princeton. So she occupies this huge space in the culture sort of in three ways. One as a writer, one as an educator and mentor for the generations of African American writers that came after her, and also as an orator. She was equally eloquent at the mic in the same way that she was on the page, which isn't true of a lot of writers once you pull them out of their garrets and put them in front of a mic. But she could do all those things and do them all equally well.
I'm so struck by you saying she was equally eloquent at the mic. Let's listen to her talking about language.
Language can never live up to life once and for all. Nor should it. Language can never pin down slavery, genocide, war. Nor should it yearn for the arrogance to be able to do so. Its force, its felicity, is in its reach toward the ineffable.
That was from her Nobel Prize acceptance speech, and it is a tour de force of a speech, except that doesn't quite seem right to say, because I think every time she opened her mouth, there was a tour de force behind it. Janae, you wrote an incredible piece for the Boston Globe where you describe how you perceived Toni Morrison's words, writing of black women, that, quote, we were empowered by not only seeing ourselves, but by the language, end quote. What was it about her language that empowered you?
I feel like Toni gave us magic and miracles and brutal beauty. and softness. If you're a little black girl, you know what it's like to sit between your mom or your auntie or your grandma's legs and get your edges pulled into braids. She was like that little massage they take to give you when it hurts a little. Just masterful. She was a creator, a real creator, not just a writer, a creator. She is a love language. I believe that.
Jabari, that seemed to really resonate with you.
Yeah, I think it's, Janae made me think of family and how important Toni Morrison was in chronicling the experience of the black family, you know, in its beauty and its ugliness, in all of it, you know. And I think also I was thinking of an anecdote where she talked about editing Muhammad Ali and how first she perceived that he had trouble respecting women, but then she thought that the way in was that he obviously respected older women. So she addressed him as if she were his mother. And that kind of brought him in. And so I think of her also in that aspect that she's a word mother, right? She's maternal. She's wise. She knows so much more than I could. And she relays it to me in a kind, generous, and forceful when necessary manner.
You talked about the fact that, you know, she presented life and its beauty and its ugliness in Beloved, which some critics have called her seminal work. When she talks about it, she essentially says that it pulled her into setting a story during slavery, which she didn't want to do. I want to play a cut of her speaking about how she ended up writing Beloved. You know, she clearly resisted where the story was calling her to go.
I had been dragged there by the force of the ideas and the characters that I had invented, and I really felt as though I were being kicked into that place, kicking and screaming and saying, why couldn't this life, this problem, this world I want to talk about be in the 1930s or something that I thought I could deal with? I just didn't want to go there. It was too painful. And then I thought, well, if they lived it, then maybe I could spend a few years simply writing it.
So it, I mean, there is sacrifice there. She sacrificed herself to the story. Janae, does this resonate with you, this idea of one's art dragging you, kicking and screaming somewhere you don't want to go?
Yeah. There's a lot of times when I don't want to sit at my laptop and write because it hurts, or I'm mad, or I'd rather scream or cry or hide or just pretend it's all not happening. I didn't want to write about Mother Morrison yesterday on deadline immediately when asked. So I threw a fit and went home first and then got it done this morning because she told us to. She told us not to despair. This is the time when artists create. This is how we heal through language. So yeah, I absolutely understand what it means to surrender to the words.
One of the things that struck me in preparing for this yesterday and today and listening to and reading interviews of her and watching her speak, she called out white interviewers often for their ignorance, their lack of understanding, for questions that they would ask her that they would never dream of asking a white author. And in fact, at one point, and I won't get this exactly right, but she talked about the fact that Americanism is defined so much as whiteness that white people are the only people who don't have to hyphenate. Everybody else has to hyphenate their Americanism. What do white people not understand about the presence and loss of Toni Morrison that needs to be especially put out in the world in her memory today, that white people need to begin to grapple with and try to understand for themselves? And I ask that question to either of you.
Well, I think white people need to do actually what black people need to do as well. When someone like Toni Morrison is speaking, I think the best response is to listen and to listen humbly without some preconceived notion of what's accurate or inaccurate about what it is she has to share. I mean, I went to her with an open mind and open arms. But I think that even if I had not, even if I had been somewhat skeptical, the power, the eloquence, the brilliance would in time have worn down my skepticism and encouraged me to close my lips and open my ears, which I think is what everyone should do in response to her.
Janae, when somebody passes away, it brings their work back into the forefront. It's a little different, I think, with Toni Morrison because I think she's actually always present. But even then, it people review, they reevaluate, they remember. So as her work is being cast back into the forefront in this particular American cultural moment, what does her work offer that we most need right now?
I'm going to answer that question, but I also want to add on to Jabari's answer about what white people need to do about Toni Morrison.
Please, and in either order, whatever works for you.
When black people die, especially when they're black giants and heroes and lions, this thing happens where we remember them as these wonderful black legends who did great things for black people. Toni Morrison did great things for people. We were center. Black people were center in her world. And I love that. But it's not just a gift to us. It's a gift to America. It's a gift to the world to see us, to really see us and grapple with that. What was the second question again?
So the second question was, what in this refocusing of attention right now on her work, in this particular turbulent, awful, I would argue, moment in America, what does her work bring that is particularly important or that we need to particularly focus on right now?
The dedication to honesty, to honesty even when it's hard, and also not just to the suffering, but to the beauty of life. Toni Morrison really understood the nuances and the fullness of life. And I feel like we get lost in the tragedy in a way that amplifies the suffering so much so that you forget the humanness.
I really want to bring her voice back in to the conversation. So this is a speech in 2004 where she questioned the idea of one generation passing their wisdom to another generation, but ended with this encouragement for the students she was speaking to. This is at Wellesley College.
You are your own stories, and therefore free to imagine and experience what it means to be human without wealth, what it feels like to be human without domination over others, without reckless arrogance, without fear of others unlike you, without rotating, rehearsing, and reinventing the hatreds you learned in the sandbox. And although you don't have complete control over the narrative, no author does, I can tell you, you can nevertheless create it.
Jabari, on Twitter yesterday, at Claire Shrugged, tweeted, quote, "The best way to honor Toni Morrison is to continue her legacy by celebrating and supporting black female writers," end quote. She included a thread of some of those writers. Who are some of the writers that you think in the legacy of Toni Morrison we should be raising up?
Well, there's so many, you know, and so the danger in just naming a handful, you appear to deliberately exclude others. So, but off the top of my head, I would say Bernice McFadden, Crystal Wilkinson, Naomi Jackson, T.R.E. Jones, just to name a few.
Thank you. Janae, who would you add?
Again, this is not, you know, the full list for either of us, but right now in this moment, I think of Jessamyn Ward. I even think of Angie Thomas, who is very new and young, but doing the work. I think of, honestly, I would just go back and read Audre Lorde, okay. who we don't read enough of.
Audre Lorde.
Mm-hmm.
So my last question then is, somebody's coming to Toni Morrison's work for the first time now, in awareness of her passing. If you could commend to them the first piece of her writing that you would want them to pick up, what would it be, Jabari?
For me, it would be The Bluest Eye. I think that's a good place to start. Actually, any place is a good place to start, but that's probably, ask me tomorrow, I might have a different answer. But today, that's
but
what
today,
I would say.
Today, that's the one. Mm-hmm. How about you, Janae?
Since he went with Bluest Eye, which I would have gone with, I'm going to go with Beloved, simply because I turned to Beloved to really honor her. There's this quote in Beloved. "She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man. The pieces I am, she gather them and give them back to me in all the right order." That's something a slave said as he was remembering someone he loved. And it's something that we can say about Toni Morrison. She gave us all the pieces in all the right order.
That was Janae Osterhelt, a cultural writer for the Boston Globe, and Jabari Asim, associate professor and director of Emerson College's Graduate Creative Writing Program. They spoke to us about Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison, who passed away in August at the age of 88. Just as Toni Morrison inspired a generation of artists through her writing, so did filmmaker John Singleton. Singleton's movies and television gave voice to the Black American experience like few, if any, had ever done before. He became the youngest and first Black person nominated by the Academy Awards for Best Director. It was for his seminal 1991 film, Boys in the Hood. John Singleton died in April at the age of 51 after complications from a stroke. Shortly after his death, WBUR's Kimberly Atkins spoke with Arielle Gray, a producer with The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team. They began their conversation with a short cut from Boys in the Hood.
I turned on the TV this morning. I had to on about living in a violent world. Showed all these foreign places. Foreigners living on. Started thinking, man. Either they don't know, don't show, or don't care about what's going on in the hood.
So I remember seeing Boys in the Hood in a packed theater when it first came out in 1991, and remembering how the genuineness of his storytelling came through in that film. What are your earliest memories of John Singleton and that film?
So, funny story. I was actually born in 91 when Boys in the Hood came out. And I was born to a young Black mother. And so I grew up watching and consuming a lot of the things that she did. And John Singleton's many films were some of those things that I've kind of got from her. So I kind of was watching what she was watching, and my earliest memory is of her being in the living room and Boys in the Hood playing on the television. And she kind of ushered me out of the room with a sense of urgency. And at that time, I didn't understand why. But now as I got older, I realized that it was a very poignant death scene that she didn't want me to see. A death scene now that we still talk about in our culture. And it was one of those films that just became this, I don't know, ubiquitous thing in Black culture. Like, if you hadn't seen Boys in the Hood, then what were you doing?
Yeah. And that scene, it was what one of the teens was shot and killed, and his brother very dramatically brought him home. What do you think it is about Singleton's work that is so compelling, that makes it so different?
I think the thing that was so interesting specifically about Boys in the Hood is that he portrays this neighborhood as kind of being the quintessential American experience. These kids have their parents. They have relationships with each other. They're building friendships. They're involved in their community. And so I think adding that nuance to a place that's usually only portrayed as violent or as ridden with, you know, gang involvement, really showed a different side of the Black experience. It was more than just the trauma and the pain that Black people face. He showed us in all of our happiness and all of our growth and also in all of our intelligence. And I think we can really crystallize that essence of his filmmaking in the character of Doughboy, who was played by Ice Cube. And he's kind of portrayed as like this gangster, right? Like, he's riding around the car with his friends. He's calling women a B-word every other sentence. But at his core, Doughboy is actually very intelligent and very perceptive. And he can see all of these things that are happening in his hood. And actually, that first quote that you guys played was him. And that's kind of one of the quotes that ends that film. And I think he was actually probably one of the most compelling characters in Boys in the Hood, precisely because he was such a nuanced character.
And we're talking about Boys in the Hood, but that was John Singleton's first major work, but it certainly wasn't his last. Talk about how his work has changed and how it's affected you.
I can't even, I mean, my childhood was riddled with Singleton's films. And I think you can really see the difference in his filmmaking, specifically when it comes to the portrayal of Black women, when you look at Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, and also Baby Boy. And so he was actually critiqued for his portrayal of Black women and motherhood, specifically in Boys in the Hood. Black mothers were kind of portrayed as being incompetent of raising Black men. And he got some backlash on that. And so with Poetic Justice, and he casted Janet Jackson in that now... and I guess her seminal role, really. Role really kind of kicked off her career as an actress. But she is smart. She's fiery. She's a poet. And actually, the poems that she reads in that movie were written by Maya Angelou. So he offered us a different glimpse into Black womanhood. And he took that criticism and then he adjusted his filmmaking accordingly.
And how do you see the influence in more modern pieces, more modern works he's worked on? He's worked on everything from Too Fast, Too Furious to Empire.
Right. I think it's always so hard to concretely track influence, right? I think he has definitely influenced a wide swath of not just filmmakers, but I think Black creatives in general. He really created a blueprint for other Black filmmakers to follow. As far as using their work to both critique Hollywood while providing us with an in-depth look into the Black experience. And to this day, people still reference his movie. We still have Black girls dressing up as Justice from Poetic Justice every single year. I think that movie single-handedly brought back the box braids.
Yes,
so,
it did.
So that in itself is just a testament to the long-lasting cultural impacts that his work had on our community.
Before we end, I want to play a clip from John Singleton's final interview, which he gave to The Hollywood Reporter last month. Let's listen.
So I'm like that to the executives. Like, you're not going to tell me what my story is. I don't feel there's a lot of people of color in the business that feel comfortable saying it's going to be like this. I don't care what the hell you say. I started when I was 22 years old. So it's like, what the hell can you tell me? It's like, you know, like you said that this wasn't going to work and it worked. And then you said this stuff was going to work and it all worked.
And it's worked. It has worked. I think we can say that he was right. Ariel, how do you want to see the next generation of filmmakers carry on Singleton's legacy into the future?
Yeah, it's funny that you guys just played that quote in a lecture that he gave in 2014. He actually, mirrored what he just said. He said, they ain't letting the Black people tell the stories, which is very true. I think a lot of us in the Black community feel like we don't actually see ourselves portrayed truthfully on screen. And so I see his legacy really being carried out in all of these amazing Black filmmakers who are using their talent to add color to our lives, because so often we're rendered in Black and white. And that's what he really tried to avoid doing with his films. We see Jordan Peele creating Black horror, Barry Jenkins portraying, Black queer identity in Moonlight, Ava DuVernay really combining film with activism. And I really think it started all with Singleton's work.
That was Ariel Gray, a producer with The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team, speaking with WBUR's Kimberly Atkins. They were remembering director John Singleton, who died in April at the age of 51. Stay with us. Coming up, legendary Cars frontman Rick Ocasek. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston, 2019 in memoriam. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are remembering some of the public figures we lost this year because we want to carry them with us into 2020. We began the hour with longtime head of the Boston Housing Authority, Bill McGonigal. We also spoke about giants in the arts, novelist Toni Morrison and filmmaker John Singleton, who each opened up new worlds for us. We want to end today's hour with a music legend, one with particular resonance here at home. Rick Ocasek, the iconic frontman of the Cars, died in September. He was 75 years old. The Cars were known all around the world for hits like Just What I Needed and Best Friend's Girl, but they came up right here in Boston Back in 2013, Ocasek spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty when he had just released a new book called Lyrics and Prose. Today we bring you part of that conversation, beginning with what brought Rick Ocasek to Boston.
I'd love to hear from you. Why is it that you did, what, back in 1972, decide to come to Boston?
Ben and I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time. We had a band called Leatherwood. And oddly enough, we used to open for Iggy Pop and the MC5. And we had to kind of abandon, kind of wreck your equipment and, thought we were, you know, pretty kind of hard stuff. But anyway, when it was time to get rid of or move, we sort of ran out of money and pawned over our equipment. And all I had left was an acoustic. And I thought that I knew that Cambridge was a good place to come with an acoustic guitar because I'd heard that you can play at Club 47 and you could play at, you know, Passiums and all those places if you had an acoustic guitar. So we ventured to Boston in 1972, arrived in Harvard Square, and heard the Modern Lovers playing on the Common.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this is the place for me. The Modern Lovers are here. It's unbelievable. We just kind of played on our own for a while, just Ben and I, acoustically. We managed to just scrape by while we were there, but we loved the city, so that's how we got there.
There's a story, which I'm dying to know if it's true or not, but I've read that in 74, you and Ben Orr were playing as a duo at a Boston Ground Round restaurant on the South Shore, and you guys were playing until a vice president or a manager stopped you one night, or actually he stopped in one night of the company, and he said you couldn't play anymore because you weren't family friendly entertainment. Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
What were you singing?
It is true.
What were you singing?
Even when we played those places in Boston in the beginning, we told people that we played top 40 stuff so we could get the gig. But then when we went there, we never played any of that. We just played my own songs. Some people thought they were top 40. And they just missed it. So that was probably the reason. We kind of got fired from a bunch of places.
That's amazing to me that you guys ever played at a Ground Round. But
We played the Ground Round quite a few times because the Ground Round actually paid. Because they could actually pay for it. So, you know.
Not bad, actually.
So we played the Ground Round. It was a weird place to play.
And obviously the rest is history because the Cars go on to be this super group of the 80s. Talking about the story behind a song on, of course, the Cars' debut album, maybe one of your most beloved songs, and that is My Best Friend's Girl.
Always dancing down the street with this way blue eyes. That you meet, it doesn't know the real surprise.
And I wanted to ask you about it because I'm looking in the new book, Lyrics and Prose, and there it is on page 5, the printed text of My Best Friend's Girl. But on the facing page, there's a photograph of what I gather to be, what is that, the original manuscript of the song?
Oh, yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah. It looks like the original song title was Best Friend's Girl. And someone hand wrote the word in my in front of that.
Yeah, that's true. It must have been me.
So the
I guess that my had to be there.
But it wasn't there to begin with?
Oh, I think maybe when I was, you know, once you start singing the song and all that stuff, maybe I was throwing in a my, so I thought I better put the my in there.
She's my best friend's girl.
Well, why don't you tell me the story of you know, the process or the background or what inspired the song?
Well, that's a good question. I could never remember that. That's like 100 years ago. I don't know that any songs I've ever written have been situations that I thought I needed to document because they were sort of historical in my mind or an historical moment.
Mm-hmm.
Although, maybe so, if I leap through, maybe so.
Let the good times roll. Let the lock you around. Let the good times roll. Let them make you a clown.
So the book, it's not just lyrics, it's called Lyrics and Prose. Do you have the book there in front of you or with you?
I kind of do. Somebody just handed it to me.
Okay, great. Because we're talking about sort of prose. Mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could read one of the prose pieces in the book called Paul's Bakery.
I'm sitting here at Paul's Bakery watching the blizzard and waiting for the studio to open. Everyone's late when the New England snow blows. I'll probably work on the same song for the rest of my life, all songs being one. Hume said that the entire world is in one's mind. All knowledge comes from sensory impression, rather than a prior aspect of reality. You don't see time, for instance. So what's the rush? Time is close. Things get quiet when it snows. Time seems to stand still, like when your mind sleeps between thoughts. So let's talk about envy and jealousy and girlfriends and music, misunderstanding, art, money, trips, death, and slime balls. Muscles, cheap talk, friends, videos, leather, business, skin, purpose, rain and bombs, lawyers, notes, and sounds. Rhythm, drugs, booze, fights, life. Environments, pleasure, rumors, images, pressure, guns, style, escape, movement, junkies, losers, motivation, jobs, and God, and smoke, and differences, and eyes, and the future, and illusions, and waste traps, and focus, and feeling, and time. It's still snowing outside Paul's Bakery, but I could suck in the smell of this place for a trillion picoseconds. Everyone's late when the New England snow blows.
Hmm. I've heard that you really don't consider yourself to be kind of a front and center entertainer, that rather,
right.
that's not who you are. So how would you describe what you consider yourself to be?
Tall.
I should have expected that. Tall, handsome, dark-haired.
Oh, I don't know about the handsome. I don't get any awards for that. But anyway, I consider myself a writer, a songwriter, for sure. It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I started writing songs, I think. I attempted to write a song when I was 14. Once I decided to play music, I immediately thought, well, I don't care if I can play the instrument. I just want to write songs. I've never considered myself a musician, although I can play a lot of things. I'm not a school musician, nor can I read music. But I always wanted to write whole songs and be a songwriter. And I knew that no matter what band I was ever in, it was going to be a band that played the songs I wrote, you know. And of course, in the early days, you know, they weren't very good songs, but I put a lot of bands through a lot of crap to make them play them until finally, you know, years and years after having a half a dozen bands, finally the songs got good enough.
you ended up being essentially the front man for one of the biggest rock groups of a generation.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how that happened.
That was Cars frontman Rick Ocasek speaking with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty. Ocasek died this September in New York. And that brings us to the end of this special hour of Radio Boston, 2019 in memoriam. We've remembered people we lost this year who had a deep and indelible effect on our lives. Let's go out on Ocasek's bandmate from the Cars, Greg Hawkes, performing You Might Think. We recorded it for Radio Boston during our first year of broadcasting in 2007.
You might think I'm crazy to hang around with you.
We want to wish you a happy and peaceful new year from everyone here on the team. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
But I think that you're wild and so uniquely styled. You might think I'm crazy to hang around with you. You might think I'm crazy, but all I want is you.